What a finish from Balogun.
Oh, Benyera, beautifully done.
Aubameyang, surely. There it is.
Mbappe now. Wonderful.
Gotta be. Lovely finish.
Go for goal. Darren Mbappe.
It's Elie Wahi. Well, it's been coming.
Put in by Jonathan Davies. Kylian Mbappe brings the Parc des Princes to its feet.
Hello and welcome to Le Beau Jeu, the official Ligue 1 Uber Eats podcast in English. Well, we knew it was coming and it's happened. Paris Saint-Germain are champions for the 12th time in the club's history and the 10th since the Qatari ownership began in 2011. But while top spot has been decided, there's still everything else to play for, starting with the European places all the way down to the relegation battle. And tensions are starting to run high. Even with just three games to go, Stade de Reims have decided to part ways with their Anglo-Belgian coach Will Still, a sacking that has surprised more than one neutral observer. Paris Saint-Germain are still in the hunt for Champions League glory. They entertain Borussia Dortmund this week at the Parc des Princes, and Marseille travel to Atalanta in the Europa League semi-final return leg. In this week's trip down memory lane, Baptiste Reynaud takes us to 2008, when Paris Saint-Germain survived the drop on the final day of the season, and we announced the winner of our signed Terram Moffey jersey, as well as giving you the chance to get a Follerin Balogun shirt from AS Monaco. And we look ahead to the final two rounds of the season. There'll be all of that and more coming up in the next, let's say, 45 minutes to an hour and 45 minutes. It all depends on how bavard my invités are this afternoon. To help me, Robbie Thompson, get through all of this, I'm joined by Jonathan Johnson and Andy Scott, a finer pair of French football experts you'd be hard-pressed to find. JJ, how are you this fine Monday morning?
Yeah, doing very well. Thanks, Robbie. Great to be on. Good to see Andy again, and very much looking forward to chewing the fat with you guys after the last couple of weeks.
There's nothing quite like it, is there, Andy, than just sitting back and chewing the fat to get your week off up and running.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Robbie. Yeah, it's funny because I turned 40 since I was last on the podcast, and you mentioning a trip down memory lane going as far back as 2008 does make me feel pretty old, because like that's not that long ago, is it? That's actually the year in which it's the year in which I moved to France. And it was just after Paris Saint-Germain had beaten the drop. They played Olympique Lyonnais in the Coupe de France final, and that was the night that I arrived in Paris to move here. And I'm still here 16 years later. So it will never feel like a long time ago to me, I suppose.
Fantastic. And what is most alarming about that, Andy, is that you arrived and you were just a young man. But I guess we all were. Weren't we?
That's yeah. I'm not anymore. Is that what you're suggesting? I'm not anymore.
Well, I've gone past the big 5-0 in the last couple of years, which is
if it's any consolation, you don't look a day over 39, Andy.
Hey, well, I have a day over 39. I'm 39 and 375 days, 66. Or something like that.
Yeah. And JJ, how old were you when you arrived? You did uni here, didn't you?
No, I did. It was before uni, so I was 16, fresh-faced, full of optimism and hope for my association with PSG, and then they dashed it in my first season with a season ticket in the Champions League, the spectacular House of Horrors, where it was a mid-table finish, and they got absolutely destroyed by Sergei Semak. Went on to sign him.
Yes, I remember.
Didn't realize he was a defensive midfielder, despite that hat-trick he scored at Parc des Princes.
If you are enjoying listening to Le Beau Jeu, don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and spread the word. Like, subscribe, follow, and recommend. Okay, well, I heard you commentating on the weekend, Andy, at the Stade Louis II, it sounded like, here on the other side of the planet. But we're going to start with the team that didn't play this weekend. It was the weekend before, Paris Saint-Germain, who managed to get their hands on the title. Andy, I know you haven't been the most glowing admirer of what Paris Saint-Germain have done this season, at least not in Ligue 1.
No.
What have you made of this? I mean, a 3-3 draw against struggling Le Havre, plenty of links between the two sides are off the field and with the people that run Le Havre as well, the sporting directors and goalkeeping coaches have very fond links with Paris Saint-Germain. But this was an entertaining match in which Gonçalo Ramos left it late to get the crucial point. And then the next day, Olympique Lyonnais finished the job.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously for them, it was nice for PSG to wrap things up before the Champions League semi-final against Dortmund. And I think from the point of view of you saying I'm being critical of PSG and I haven't been, well, glowing in praise of PSG this season, that is true. But I think in the final assessment, you have to say that it's been a terrific season in Ligue 1 for them. When you compare it to last year, I think I'm right in saying they lost 7 games in Ligue 1 last year. They I think it was with one game to spare that they finally saw off the challenge of Lens. This time they've lost one game all season. That was against Nice in September. They have drawn a lot of matches, 10 draws in 31 games so far. But Luis Enrique has often used the league to experiment. We've seen that particularly in recent weeks. Kylian Mbappe, of course, hasn't always been in the team. He has frequently been rested ahead of Champions League matches. But Luis Enrique has realised that he can use the league as something of a laboratory almost to prepare for the Champions League and, as he says, to prepare for next season. And they've got the job done comfortably. I don't know if you can say glow. It's difficult to be glowing in praise of PSG in the league because their budget is so enormous. I mean, if you think about the finances at PSG, the reality is that they are, I think last year they had the third or fourth biggest revenue in world football at more than €800 million. That's the income, of course. That's not taking into account the huge expenses they have. And I think the next biggest income of any club in France was Marseille, about €250 million. So the gap is just it's a chasm. It's enormous. So the idea that anybody should compete with them in the league is just rarely going to happen. And that's been borne out in the fact that PSG have won 10 of the last 12 titles. All we want as commentators or neutral fans is some kind of title challenge every year. It's not transpired this time because some other teams have not had their house in order, but that's not PSG's fault. And I think that they ultimately have been by far and away the best team in the country, even though they've dropped some silly points at times. The Le Havre game, the Clermont game a few weeks ago, these are matches they would usually win comfortably. But they've won the league and they might well win a clean sweep of trophies. I mean, we're sitting here on the eve of the Borussia Dortmund game. They could still win the Champions League. They should win the Coupe de France. And then you would say it would be the greatest season, of course, in their history. So, you know, things are looking pretty good and Luis Enrique does deserve a lot of credit.
Well, JJ, I remember very fondly that 2015-16 season under Laurent Blanc, where Paris Saint-Germain, I think, got as close as they've ever been probably to Champions League success in terms of the way they were playing. They only made it to the quarterfinals in the end with that coming unstuck at Manchester City and the famous switch to three at the back from Laurent Blanc away. But that season, Paris Saint-Germain racked up 96 points. They lost 2 games. We play 4 games less this season, only the one loss so far. Where do you rate this season and this performance from Luis Enrique's Paris Saint-Germain, with the small caveat that, of course, they could yet obliterate all past records by going to the final of the Champions League and possibly winning it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you need to sort of look at, their domestic record and their continental record in completely different lights. I think in terms of the domestic record, I think since Qatar arrived, it's what, 10 titles out of a possible 13? Because let's not forget Montpellier pipped into the title in that first year of Qatari ownership as well. But in terms of the continental record, it's actually looked a lot better in the last 5 years, despite their domestic performances not having been as convincing, as Andy rightly pointed out, especially last season. I think this is the third time out of the last 5 editions of the Champions League that they've made the semi-finals. Sure, there's still been some sort of crushing disappointment in the earlier rounds of the knockout phases, but that, you know, is sort of more in line with what PSG's Qatari owners wanted from the first 10 years at the club than sort of what they actually ended up getting. So I think, you know, for me, I think it's a huge opportunity still, despite the 1-goal deficit from the first leg, an opportunity that PSG and Kylian Mbappe, would be foolish to allow to pass them by. You know, the last 2 times that they've played Dortmund at home, they've come out 2-0 winners, which would be enough to see them advance. if they can replicate what happened in 2020, but obviously, of course, earlier this season in the group stage as well. But, you know, as we saw last week, it's not going to be an easy task. But I think it is made easier by the fact that the league has been tied up and they don't have to worry about that. Obviously, they still have the Coupe de France final against Lyon to think about. And, you know, should they be able to get to the Champions League final, you know, have gone to the Coupe de France final and have wrapped up the Ligue 1 title with, what, 3-4 games to spare? I think that is a very impressive first season return from Luis Enrique. It's far more convincing than many of his predecessors have managed since at least Thomas Tuchel, you know, if not sort of, you know, even before that. So I think while, yes, in terms of finances and in terms of the squad depth that PSG have and quality and depth over everybody else, you would expect them to be far more dominant than they've been in the last couple of years. So I think, you know, if you're going to accept that PSG are going to be the dominant force in Ligue 1, you want to see them, you know, being dominant and sort of dominating with that squad depth being used, not just sort of, you know, being flat track bullies. And at this moment in time, sort of PSG's approach to Ligue 1, you know, under Luis Enrique, is actually starting to see some benefits on the continental stage. And overall, I think there is a bit of an argument as well that you could say Ligue 1 has started to get its act together. Whether you can attribute that to having these clubs try to compete with PSG is, you know, a different argument for another day. But overall, I think we are now entering into a period where it does feel like clubs in Ligue 1 are not necessarily being made to pay for what many people perceive to be a lack of competitiveness. I think, you know, Ligue 1 clubs are finally starting to show their worth, which is great. It's something that we've known for years. You know, and I think the more clubs that we can have sort of at a similar level to PSG's performances, as long as they can sort of remain in that sort of last 5-year spell where they've reached the semis 3 times, you know, that the future for French football is bright, despite what many people would say about PSG's domination statistically, you know, certainly since the Qataris arrived.
Well, you say it's a debate we can have another day. I think maybe we'll chat about it a little bit later in Paris Saint-Germain's role in France and in the Champions League as well, when we chat about the game coming up against Borussia Dortmund. I'll leave that one hanging for now, but I'm interested in how domestic leagues are changing all over the world these days, and how much, you know, you look at Germany or Italy. England is the real sole exception at the moment, where you have 3 teams, more or less, 2 or 3 still battling for the title. But everywhere else, you're talking 20 points in the other 4 main leagues in Europe, between first and second, basically. So, well, 15, 20 points. So it's interesting. And if you want to compete on a continental level, you have to be in this sort of ballpark, because the final 8 teams left every year in continental competition are big guns, are juggernauts. Anyway, let's keep moving. The other big news after Paris Saint-Germain got their hands on that title was that Will Still is no longer Still Will at Reims. Andy, did you see this coming? I think it's only 3 wins in 2024. He was such the golden boy of coaching, you know, one of these young kids coming through with great ideas. His first game in charge was a scoreless draw against Paris Saint-Germain. He took Reims on a 19-game unbeaten run. It looked like he could do no wrong. All of a sudden, is it true that he can do no right?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think this has been coming, actually. I think if you go back a number of months, one of the things that maybe unsettled people in Reims was that he gave an interview, didn't he?
Yeah.
Where he basically said he would go and work in English Championship, which might have been taken as an affront to some people at Reims or around French football. Of course, Will Still is you know, born and brought up in Belgium, but English parents. I think I'm right in saying he studied a university course in the northwest of England. He's obviously got a very sort of English mindset and is aware and proud of his English heritage, and he hasn't really hidden the fact that he would like to go and work there one day. He had tremendous success at the beginning at Rance. I think he's always been aware that it's difficult to maintain that over a long period of time at any club, really, outside the very elite. You know, you're not going to repeat a run of 19 games unbeaten in all competitions very easily when you're at a club like Rance. He set the bar very high. They were doing fine this season. They've tailed away, but actually it's only really in the last couple of weeks that it's become clear that they're not going to qualify for Europe. So that's not bad going. You know, they're going to finish in mid-table. And you know, clearly things have been fracturing to some extent between him and the club, and they've decided to end that association. And then they decided, well, we've agreed to end the association. Well, let's just end it now. And he goes now, and they will look forward to the future. And he's got a bit more time to take stock and work out where his next job is. So, you know, it doesn't mean that it's been a failure for Will Still. It's been a very successful 18 months in charge of Rance. I think, you know, he is a coach with a huge future ahead of him. I think from his point of view, what he does next is very important. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, as I said, about a move to the English Championship. Apparently he said he's happy to go and work there. There are so many big clubs with big supports who they could maybe take into the Premier League. Sunderland was the one that was mentioned at one point. There might be others. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's more likely than a move straight to the Premier League. And that becomes a big step for him because, you know, that might make or break his career, really, what he does next. I think what he's done at Rance is very impressive. And I think that actually that's important because I think Rance have a part to play in that. I think they were a club in a bit of a shaky situation when he came in. He steadied the ship. But if you look at the work they've done in terms of consolidating in Ligue 1, because although they're a club with a terrific history, you know, two European Cup finals in the early post-war period, six French titles, they are a modest club from a provincial city, the type of club who you would say that kind of profile would spend a few years in the top division, maybe drop back down again. And so for them to establish themselves in Ligue 1 has been impressive, the way in which they've done it. They have signed some really interesting players. The idea they often bring players in and sell them on at a profit. If you look at the profile of players, they've got lots of different nationalities, lots of players coming in from, for example, the Belgian League, players coming in from Africa, helping them develop. So they've done terrific work off the pitch. It's not just about Will Still. It's about the sporting director, the backing of the president, the environment at the club. And I think that means that from a Rance perspective, given that Will Still's probably going to be heading abroad and not working in France anymore, I think that from a Rance perspective, the future does look bright for them. And I think that they need to keep on working in the same direction. Of course, who they bring in next as coach is going to be important, but they've got plenty to build on.
JJ, I think Andy's hit on something which is the real crux of this whole decision, which is Rance are a side, yes, they've managed to stabilize themselves in the top flight and be there, but they have a whole other plan. And there are lots of teams around the world now, particularly in Netherlands, France, Belgium, but also in Spain and Italy, these sides that you look at a team like Atalanta, who have you know, started probably 10 years ago, of just finding, you know, very underrated players all over, even in the Netherlands, in Bosnia, in all over the place, Switzerland, Scandinavia, and bringing them in and turning them into a team and turning them into names that are getting experience and then go on. Look at a club like Toulouse, who bring in a young Spanish coach. We've got younger coaches. There was a great interview with the Marseille president a couple of weeks ago, talking about how he compiles his squad and talking about, I need a certain number of players that were born in this year. I need a more experienced player to help them. I need players with the potential to sell on. And this, you really need, when you're choosing a coach, you're no longer choosing a coach a la Jean-Louis Gasset to win matches. In the end, Marseille did that because they had to, and Marseille are a bigger club. They're not necessarily in this conversation. But these smaller clubs that go for a young coach, they are looking for a very specific type of coach. And it's not necessarily to qualify for European football or to compete with the very top teams in the league. It's to develop players. It's to have a model that will profit, will end up in the red, with money, with profit, and with revenue coming in for developing and selling on players, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think it is going to be fascinating. I agree with Andy to see sort of what comes next, because I think that'll ultimately be the acid test of sort of how much of a difference Will Still really made, because it's easy to forget where Hans were when he came in by default almost. And I do think it's a shame to see sort of basically essentially the difficulty at the origin of one of his first departures from the club basically come back and sort of refracture, because one of the things that left, you know, a difficult relationship to be salvaged when he returned, you know, was basically the way that he left the first time. And now sort of leaving the second time, I think it's because Haas felt like really at the end of the day, there was not necessarily the commitment to the project. But equally at the same time, from Will Still's point of view, when you are ambitious, when you are hoping to challenge for Europe with such modest resources, it doesn't help sort of seeing the furniture sold around you in the January transfer window, which, you know, is believed to have been a major gripe on his part, because there was basically no replacement, certainly not for somebody as influential as Matusiwa.
But and does this mean that he's moving beyond the project, or no longer sees himself needing different things than the project? Because the project is clear what it is at a club like Reims. Andy mentioned they've found players from Australia, from Venezuela, from America, from Africa. It's not about trying to win the league.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, it's not that. But I think at the time when that decision was made towards the end of the January transfer window, there was an opportunity for Hans to say, well, perhaps if we keep this group together now, we go to Europe, and then the value of those players is higher and you can rebuild over the summer, as opposed to trying to find a last-minute replacement in the winter window, which is notoriously difficult. And I think that decision in particular was one that really frustrated Will Still. I have to say, I'm surprised that he would be so willing to drop down to the Championship if that's what he ultimately does, given that his stock was so high that he was being linked with his beloved West Ham, which sounds like an opening that's going to be sort of available in the coming sort of weeks and months. Now that it sounds like he's not really in the running for that, you do wonder if perhaps Will Still has equally been sort of seem to be lacking ambition in the way that he sort of says that he'd be fine with a Championship job, yet, you know, up until very recently, there would have been Premier League clubs looking at his record being feeling, you know, quite encouraged about the possibility of maybe trying to make a move for him. But again, it goes back now for Haas, at least to what Andy was saying and sort of who comes in. I know there's a lot of speculation about whether we'd see Habib Bey sort of upgrading from Red Star, who are now Ligue 2 bound, to come to the top flight. Maybe that's an opening that's, you know, surfacing at the right time. but equally, this could be, you know, a curse for Haas as well, because other managers who could come in, whether that's Habib Bey, whether that's somebody else, will look at the difficulties that Will Still encountered and wonder if actually replicating that success is going to potentially be detrimental towards their development, as opposed to the platform that it could be, you know, for an ambitious coach who thinks that they can perhaps push Haas on and maybe with a couple of adjustments still compete for Europe while remaining within the confines of the project. I agree the project is the right one for Haas to have, but equally at the same time, perhaps there was maybe a need for a bit of a sort of a short-term sacrifice for long-term success in January, which wasn't taken.
Well, Reims currently find themselves in 12th place. They're level on points with Toulouse and Montpellier above them on goal difference. It is mathematically possible that they could still reach 7th place, but that would require every single team above them collapsing in a heap, which, let's face it, is not going to happen. Andy, one team on the move is Monaco. We spoke about it in the last couple of pods that Brest, would they be able to hold on? Nice have fallen away, and now we see Monaco just coming over the top. You called their game on the weekend. You know, they conceded an equalizing goal in the first half but bounced back immediately, and we in the end saw some quality attacking football from them.
Yeah, that's the thing that Monaco have, and that's really why they should be a Champions League team, because they have the means, despite the very small crowds at the Stade Louis II, they have the means to sign good players. And you look at the team that played at the weekend. What's really interesting about Monaco this season, I think, is, well, obviously you've got Wissam Ben Yedder, who's still the top scorer, and I think when you look ahead to next year, that's interesting because his contract is up and by all accounts he is leaving. But Adi Hütter has done a good job with Takumi Minamino, who had a tricky first season at Monaco, but has done really well this season. Folarin Balogun is settling, and I imagine that the plan next season will be that he becomes the main man once Ben Yedder has got on his way. Alexander Golovin wasn't playing in that match. He's a brilliant footballer, but he's out for the rest of the remaining games of the season due to injury. And despite that, despite being without him, despite having Balogun on the bench, they had terrific attacking force, because one of the really big things for Monaco at the end of this season is that Braylon Bolo is back again, and he's a really good player. I mean, he has been injury prone, and he's had this knee injury which has kept him out all season. He came off the bench in the last three games. He finally got his first start at the weekend against Clermont. So big and strong, athletic, offers so much to the team. And if they keep him fit for next season, then that's a massive asset. And I think also for him coming back now is big as well, because he's coming back to fitness at just the right time, ahead of probably, you would imagine, maybe making the Swiss squad for the Euro. So they have depth, and that is a big thing. One of Monaco's big problems in recent years has been that their defence has been a bit susceptible, and that's been the case this season, no matter what permutation Adi Hütter has gone with at the back. But I think when you look at the league, you'd say that they might yet not finish in second place, but you have to fancy them to finish in the top three, and you would say that they deserve to be in the top three. That means automatic Champions League qualification, of course, rather than having to worry about a potential exit in the preliminary round. So I think that Monaco deserve to be there. I think they can be an asset. I think they will strengthen ahead of a Champions League push. Of course, there are now more games in the Champions League next year, more prize money, so they'll invest more money. And I think it looks good for Monaco. I have to say, I think it looks good. They've got so many really excellent players. And even though there will be changes, because it won't just be Ben Yedder, I imagine that Youssouf Fofana will probably be sold this summer, and maybe one or two others. But they have great potential and plenty to build on.
JJ, Lille are in fourth, just behind Brest. They're 2 points behind them, but they have a match in hand. Are they the side that are going to break Brest hearts? Because Nice don't look like they're going to do it, even though they still have a game in hand as well. They're 6 points behind Brest. Now, I think Nice are more focused on what's coming up behind them in the form of Lens and Rennes, who are sort of just unable to get things going. Then come Marseille and Lyon. But let's focus on that fourth, fifth Europa League kind of position. And are Lille able to pip Brest for that third place?
I certainly think they are. I think the game in hand is really interesting, because obviously against Lyon, it's not a gimme, given sort of Lyon's turnaround in form. And if you look at their three remaining games at the time that we record, one is against Lyon, another is against Nice, so not necessarily easy games. And the other one is pretty tricky as well, against Nantes, a Nantes side who have been dragged sort of back down towards that relegation playoff of late. So, you know, if Lille are to do it, you know, they really need to make the most of that game in hand. My feeling is that based on the fact that two of those three games are at home, I think they probably will just about do it. But again, I go back to the point that I made on on the podcast recently. For Brest to even have sewn up what they have already, which is a Europa League place, that is a phenomenal achievement. And just because they don't necessarily finish in a Champions League place doesn't mean that we should sort of lessen the kudos that Eric Waugh and the team deserve, because for them to book their place in Europe by this stage is a superb achievement. And I think maybe the fact that they've been so high up in the table for so much of the season and that they were sort of, I'm not going to say regressing to the mean, but sort of, you know, their form was dying down a little bit. I don't think that regulation of where they are should necessarily be viewed negatively. I think they've done fantastically, and it is a huge achievement that shouldn't be understated. The fact that they've already booked a Europa League spot. So sure, Champions League would be the cherry on the cake. Despite what the naysayers would say, the plenty of detractors coming out saying it's a bad image for French football that a club like Brest, in such a small stadium, might represent Ligue 1 on the continental stage. I don't think that's true. I think at the end of the day, if you deserve to qualify for the Champions League, you deserve your shot at the big time. But I do think that regardless of whether it's Champions League or Europa League, Brest should be applauded for what they've managed to achieve this season.
The French aren't always into their fairy tales. Was it Lusignan a few years ago, who thought they'd got their hands on a pretty good fairy tale up into the second division, and it never materialized just because the powers that be said you are too small to play at this level. I mean, what's wrong with Brest doing something like this? It's incredible. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity, and I think you've got to look at it as really, apart from behind Paris Saint-Germain, and we always talk about this need to have big clubs that perform at their highest level, you know, the locomotives, the ones that drive a league. But you also love these surprise package stories. I mean, this is something that should be celebrated. Anyway, I'm not gonna get out my little violins and nostalgic romantic notions. Let's have a look, Andy, down the other end. Despite that big win 2 weeks ago, Clermont are essentially down. Lorient are basically down. It's 3 points from them to Metz. Now, Metz are showing a little bit of fight. They lost 2-1 to Lille, and then they lost 3-2 to Rennes. So it's still two defeats, but they are showing plenty of fight. Miko Tadze is finding the back of the net. Le Havre are showing plenty of fight as well, and perhaps surprising. Big win over Strasbourg. Patrick Vieira said he was furious with his side's performance. He said he didn't understand how professional players basically could be so bad. How do you see this playing out? Is it too little too late for the bottom two and Metz into the playoff? Because we're talking about 3 point gaps now in the bottom four.
Yeah, I think the weekend was important at the bottom of the table because Le Havre got that win and, you know, they hadn't been winning games, but it was a very important time to get the result. I think it's going to be very hard for Clermont and Lorient to avoid automatic relegation now. Lorient have been in a dreadful run, absolutely dreadful run. It's a long losing streak at the worst possible time. Hard to see them turning that around. The other thing is that Lorient and Clermont play each other on the final day of the season, so they can't both survive. I think they'll both end up going down automatically, and then Metz probably have to certainly take 4 points at the very least in the last two games. Is that likely? No. I mean, they've got the 3 points behind Le Havre. They also have a much worse goal difference than Le Havre. So even though in Georges Mikel Tadze, they've probably arguably got the best striker of any club in the bottom five or six, but he got sent off at the weekend against Rennes. I think it's too much for Metz, and that's tremendous, because if you look at Metz, their record over the last 20 years or so, the number of relegations and promotions is incredible. Of course, they just came back up last year. Now they may well go straight back down. They've even had a relegation to the third tier and a promotion back from the third tier this century, and that may well continue. But, you know, if they get into the playoff, maybe that'll be enough for them. The only thing I would say about that is that the three teams in the second division, well, Auxerre have pretty much wrapped up promotion now, but Angers and Saint-Étienne are competing for second place in Ligue 2. And whichever one of them doesn't go up automatically might still fancy the chances in a playoff, because they've both been having pretty good seasons. Saint-Étienne, of course, are a huge club, desperate to come back up. And just sometimes you have that bit more momentum when you've been winning games in the second division compared to a club who've been losing games a lot in the top flight. So the playoff could still be tricky for whoever ends up in it. But I think, yeah, the current bottom two are surely going to go down, and I would still expect Metz to be the team in the playoff, albeit I must admit I've not checked who they play. They play Paris Saint-Germain, of course, at home on the last weekend. Netwich is not going to be easy, even though PSG won the title. Next weekend, the derby in Strasbourg. So I think it might be tricky for Metz.
Looking at Ligue 2 very quickly, Auxerre are 6 points clear of Saint-Étienne and Angers. Then there's a gap down to Rodez. There are some big teams down there that aren't even in the conversation. Stade Malherbe, Deucon, Guingamp, Grenoble are there, Bastia and Ajaccio, Troyes, who were in the top flight just last season. Their descent to hell continues. And there are going to be massive ramifications for what happened on the weekend. We won't go into that, but there was a lot of unrest, I think we'll say, from the supporters there at Troyes with their side in desperate need of points. And Bordeaux, of course, are the other team who are just sitting there in mid-table now, a massive, massive club. Mind you, it's not everyone that can be Paris Saint-Germain and leading for years and years and years at the top of the table. Not even Paris Saint-Germain, because while they have spent much more time of late stacking up the trophies than worrying about survival, there was a time that the capital club were on the brink of disaster. They have never, ever been relegated from the top flight ever since they first were promoted to it back in 1974. But they were staring down the barrel of relegation at the end of the 2007-08 season. There was no sign of a Qatari takeover. There was no Zlatan or Neymar or Messi or Mbappe on the horizon. And we have our very own French football history specialist, Baptiste Reynaud, who's going to bring us this story of the unlikely hero who, in this timeline at least, deserves his place in Paris Saint-Germain's Hall of Fame.
17th of May, 2008, Stade Auguste Bonal of Sochaux. 74th minute of the final game of the 2007-2008 season between PSG and Sochaux, and the home fans are jumping with joy. Defender Guirán Endo has just headed in an equaliser from a woefully defended corner, bringing Sochaux back into the game at 1-1. Whilst Les Lyonceaux are already safe no matter the result, the home fans still celebrate the potential of a famous win. For the opposition is the Club de la Capitale, and Sochaux are sending them down to Ligue 2 with just over 15 minutes to go. The Eagle of the Azores, the great Pedro Miguel Paoletta, of 109 goals for PSG, is staring into the abyss in his final game for the club. OM's great rivals, the 1996 Cup Winners' Cup victors, the team of Rai, Leonardo and Ronaldinho, is in the process of getting relegated. Alas, neither the great striker nor his experienced teammates Jérôme Roten, Mario Yepes and Michael Landreau seem able to do anything about it. In a game reflecting their dire season and 2 years of hell under new private equity owners Colony Capital, club legend and manager Paul Le Guen seems at a loss to motivate his troops. All are petrified by the terrifying prospect of what is unfolding. Sochaux are on the brink of sending a shockwave through French football. And yet, at the nadir of the history of this great club, steps up the most unlikely saviour imaginable. A journeyman striker, Amara Diané, who joined the club from Strasbourg in 2006 after seasons at the Stade de Reims and US Roy in the lower tiers of French football. In the 83rd minute, the Ivorian striker chases a hopeless ball forwards before benefiting from a mix-up between goalkeeper Teddy Richer and defender Rafiu Afolabi to see his weak shot trickle in. PSG are saved, and fans and owners alike breathe a huge sigh of relief. It's a real sliding doors moment for the great club. 3 years later, and with some semblance of stability brought back to the club, PSG are acquired by a new actor after Colony Capital had indicated an unwillingness to invest further into the side, no doubt traumatised by events on and off the pitch, with relations with the supporters' clubs difficult. Qatar Sports Investment acquire 70% of the club's shares, taking a controlling stake in PSG and ushering in a new era in which winning the Ligue 1 becomes an afterthought, and ambitions skyrocket ever upwards whilst players of the ilk of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Neymar, Lionel Messi and Kylian Mbappe join the club and challenge for glory once again. But would PSG have ever found itself in that situation had that journeyman striker not saved them from ignominy? Would a PSG in Ligue 2 fighting the likes of Paris FC and Red Star, other lesser clubs of the capital, have been as attractive to rich political investors? We will never know, but on the 17th of May 2008 we came very close indeed. And what of Amara Diané then? In a sign of things to come, PSG saviour would leave the club that summer of 2008, aged only 26, to join a Qatari club, Al Rayyan, before finishing his career anonymously in that part of the world. But in a sense, he might have been PSG's most important player of the last 20 years.
Yes, well, they were the days back for Paris Saint-Germain back in 2008. Paul Le Guen had had won the league with Olympique Lyonnais and done amazing things there. He'd been to Scotland with Rangers and hadn't enjoyed such success. And then that continued at Paris Saint-Germain. But he was, of course, a former Paris Saint-Germain legend as well, Paul Le Guen, and France international central defender and defensive midfielder back in the day, but mostly central defender. He did some strange things during his tenure as well. He, of course, is the man that gave a 17-year-old Mamadou Sakho his debut and gave him the captain's armband when they headed to Valenciennes one game as well, which none of us could quite believe, sending the kids up just because he was so frustrated at wit's end with that playing squad. It was a difficult time for Paris Saint-Germain, and it really is amazing to think that they are where they are right now. And where Paris Saint-Germain are right now is on the brink of a Champions League final. They lost the first leg at the Signal Iduna Park last Wednesday by a 0-0. Niklas Füllkrug with the only goal of the game. It was a desperately simple goal to be scored at this kind of level, JJ, wouldn't you say? Paris Saint-Germain, Lucas Hernandez did his knee while attempting, in some respects, to try and stop Niklas Füllkrug from scoring that goal. Everything that could have gone wrong basically did go wrong in that first leg, but Luis Enrique was saying, calmos, calmos, this was us playing away the first leg, now we head home. It's going to be the first time that Dortmund have had to play the second leg away from home in this knockout phase as well. He sounded very confident, and I get the feeling Paris Saint-Germain are quite confident, JJ.
Yeah, and I think rightly so. I mean, I think PSG obviously will be disappointed to have lost 1-0, but equally at the same time, they'll feel if they create the same number of chances at home, then they will score the goals needed to go through. I think it was a strange game in many respects. You know, similar in many ways to back in 2020 when PSG lost the first leg 2-1, so lost by a goal, still managed to win by two goals in the home leg to advance. But that was in the round of 16 with a bit less pressure involved, and obviously just before COVID shut down everything in world football. But I think with this one, it's a huge blow on Hernandez, by the way. I think for my money, he's been one of the most consistent and versatile performers for this PSG side this season. So desperately sad for him, not just to see his club season ended, but his Euro hopes as well. He's been desperately unlucky with injuries over the last couple of years. And I do feel that he is a very underrated performer, was with Bayern Munich, is with France, and is often still, you know, quite underrated with PSG as well. So best wishes to him in returning. Not good for PSG, obviously, to have two France internationals having suffered such devastating injuries, especially sort of at the stage of their careers with Hernandez, but also Presnel Kimpembe. But in terms of going back to the game, I think Luis Enrique will feel that if PSG create the same quality of chances that we saw at Signal Iduna Park, then they can definitely feel confident about going through. I mean, if you think about the chances that PSG missed alone, and yes, Dortmund also missed some massive opportunities. Donnarumma makes a huge save. Füllkrug should score when it blazes over in the end. Dembele did the same at the other end, though. PSG hit the post twice within 30 seconds. Fabian Ruiz, if he puts his header anywhere on target, basically scores. So there were opportunities, and I think that's the difference. PSG always create chances now, and it goes back to the debate we had earlier about Luis Enrique experimenting with the side. You're seeing the fruits of that labor. He was finally able to settle on an 11 that he preferred after that second leg away at Barcelona. Obviously, that's taken a huge blow now because he'll have to rejig the defense. Also, Kylian Mbappe did look a bit better when he was moved out wide as opposed to starting through the middle. Could that potentially be an opportunity for somebody like Gonçalo Ramos? I think so. And if you put Ramos into that team now based on the form that he's shown, you know, some superb goals recently, the header against Le Havre, the header against Lyon, you know, he is a guy who seems primed to take the next opportunity that comes his way. And if that is on Tuesday night for PSG at home to Dortmund, you know, I think that he would take that opportunity and be one of potentially the heroes for PSG. It is a big question mark now what Luis Enrique does in terms of patching up the defense. But overall, I think despite a few hairy moments in the midfield, which you could perhaps fix to a degree with Ugarte if you wanted to sort of anchor that midfield. I think PSG will feel confident that they're able to create the chances in front of what will be an absolutely boiling Parc des Princes atmosphere and score the goals needed to go through.
Andy, Paris Saint-Germain and the Champions League. We know that when QSI took over in 2011, they said, perhaps ill-advisedly, that in 5 years we want to have won the Champions League. In 2020, under Thomas Tuchel, in that COVID-affected season, they made the Champions League final. The next year, with Mauricio Pochettino, they made the semi-finals. As JJ said, now, for the third time in five seasons, it's semi-finals again. I feel that they get a bit of a bum rap from the rest of Europe looking at them, saying they're underperforming. Three semi-finals in 5 years is not a bad return. It doesn't stack up to Real Madrid. But my point is, not so much to get your opinion on that, perhaps, than because I know what it is. But more so, if you want to have a team that can compete at this level and that can achieve that, you have to be talking about these ballpark finances. And I think this season, we also saw that the rest of Ligue 1, as JJ mentioned at the top of the program, has progressed as well. And perhaps that is one of the effects now over a decade on of this Paris Saint-Germain impact on Ligue 1 is that Marseille have already been at this stage of the secondary competitions as well. But a Lille can perform well, a Rennes can do well in European competition. And isn't this also, gonna do well for Ligue 1 in general?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I think so. I have to say, right, if you're bringing Marseille into the conversation, I've actually been at the Velodrome frequently this season for the Europa League games. And I think that when a lot of people say that French football, that they don't have the, you need that something, that the culture, it's so almost an intangible thing that helps you have success in European competition. And most French clubs don't have that. Well, Marseille do have that. If you look at their record, obviously they're the only French club still to have ever won the Champions League. They were UEFA Cup finalists in 1999, 2004, Europa League runners-up in 2018. They were in the Conference League semis 2 years ago. They have history and experience when it comes to doing well in Europe, and there is something about them this season in Europe which has driven them on to this stage in the Europa League, even though they have not been, frankly, they've not been very good in the league. And I'm not actually sure that they've got a great team. I mean, they've invested a lot of money. They are French football's second biggest club in terms of revenue, in terms of support. I think they're probably still the biggest club in France. They've got a vast support. But in terms of the actual quality of the squad, it's not brilliant. That is reflected in their league position. And yet in Europe, they're in the semi-finals. And I wouldn't actually be surprised if they get to the final. I think Atalanta are a better team than them, but I wouldn't be surprised if they get to the final. But for the rest of French football, I do not buy into anyone suggesting that PSG's utterly crushing dominance of the rest of French football can in any way be a good thing for the league as a whole. By definition, it is not, because you cannot have one club in a league that is so much richer than everybody else, and that is somehow in the long run a good thing. It's not. France is a big country with a great footballing tradition, despite everything, with brilliant players, and it just so happens that sometimes they're going to have some success. They could do better, but they've got good teams.
But the question is, Andy, the question is it for the good of the league then that France has no one that can compete at the tail end of the Champions League? Because Marseille are not going to compete. They can compete in a Europa League or a Conference League. The other sides can compete. But if Paris Saint-Germain pull back their spending and say, okay, we're only going to spend 300 million like Lyon and Marseille, and that will be our revenue, and then there is no chance, because this is, and I think, I'm looking from Australia now, and I see a lot of Paris Saint-Germain jerseys around in the streets here. We see a lot of, the big clubs. Paris Saint-Germain are one of the big clubs now. Yeah. And without advocating for a Super League, that's essentially what we have. And that's what it will become even more with the Champions League. And maybe, isn't that a way of flying the French flag that the rest of France just has to accept?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, put it this way, people of my age and older are not going to get football back to the way it used to be, and we would say is better. So of course there have to be other ways looked at. I mean, yeah, PSG's record in Europe, it has been it is much better for French football that PSG are doing well in Europe, and I appreciate what you said before about their past record in the Champions League. I think there are two ways of looking at that. To give you the exact numbers, since the Qatari takeover in 2011, they came back into the Champions League in 2012. In the 11 seasons between then and the end of last season, they'd won 9 knockout ties in 11 seasons. 5 of them came in the COVID era. So 2 of them were one-off ties in neutral stadiums behind closed doors. Another 3, I'm including the Dortmund game in 2020 when they won the second leg in an empty stadium. Another 3 were won behind closed doors. Can you really count them? Not in the same way as the other ones. So their record in the Champions League over the last 12 years has not been good enough. However, despite that, this year they have done well. And also despite what you have to say is a favourable draw, you have to say, to get to this stage. Mm-hmm. Real Sociedad in the last 16 was the best draw they could have got. Dortmund now is the best draw
Dortmund.
They could have hoped for. Yeah. But we're sitting here on Monday lunchtime. They haven't beaten Dortmund yet. And if they don't beat Dortmund, that will be another, you have to say, another huge failure. So let's just see what happens tomorrow. But I think that they should beat Dortmund. I think they will, but I might be wrong.
Dortmund, I mean, I agree with you, Andy, but I think you also have to look. I think Dortmund are they in the top 10 for spending clubs in the world and have a budget of 430 million? So just outside sort of, you know, the top 8. I think we like to make
12th.
Dortmund into this.
Robbie, Dortmund had 12th. The 12th biggest revenue in world football.
So they've
last
done very
year.
Well.
12th biggest revenue, but barely half that of Paris Saint-Germain. That's the thing. Of course.
JJ. You know.
I think the other thing to bear in mind as well, when we're looking at Ligue 1 in Europe, sort of outside of the PSG angle as well, there are a lot of big clubs in France that have sort of paid the price for the competitive nature of Ligue 1 outside of PSG in the last couple of years. We mentioned Ligue 2 earlier. If you take Bordeaux and Saint-Étienne, the history that they have in Europe, and if they were in a position to regularly be exposed to European football, that could be a whole different debate for French football. If you have two powers like that potentially back at continental level, it's a long way away at the moment, especially given sort of the existential crisis that Bordeaux are going through and probably will go through even more this summer. But also you look at the shoots of hope as well with a club like Lens, you know, that has the cult following that it does, you know, to be able to potentially compete in the future. We've had Auxerre as well, the fantastic years when they were sort of flying the flag for French football on the continent. And I think French football has had a bit of an identity crisis over the last sort of 10 years or so, which has coincided with the most part of PSG's time under Qatari ownership while playing in Europe, in that some of the traditional powers, the clubs that you would expect to be most competitive, Lyon as well, another massive example, have kind of fallen off the pace a little bit. And I think should some of those clubs, as many of them as possible, be able to sort of get back into a position where they can regularly compete, then, you know, potentially it could be a different debate for Ligue 1 in the future. And hopefully that is what will happen. But there are too many
But this
many
is the
clubs.
History of French football, isn't it? I mean, this is the history of the great Saint-Étienne side in the 1970s, the great Bordeaux side of the 1980s, the great Nantes side of the 1990s. While other countries...
Has Tom Williams slipped you a fiver to promote his new book?
No, well, I haven't seen Tom Williams. I saw the book come out and... Yeah, I was thinking because Matt Spiro's book was, I guess, national team based. But no, do we talk a lot about this? Do we?
It's a good read so far.
Yeah. Well, I already know it all. I don't need to read another book about it. But the point is that when other countries were building and accepting to be dominated and uber dominated by one or two teams in the 1950s, 60s, 70s. When your Ajax was built, when your Bayern was built, when your Real Madrid was built, when your Liverpools and your Arsenals and your Manchester Uniteds were being built, France didn't do that. France didn't build it. And so now France is paying the price for having this uniform league behind this mastodon, which is Paris Saint-Germain. It's just the way it is. But the league has always been more uniform over the last 40, 50 years than the other big leagues, hasn't it? Or am I missing something here?
I will say that it was striking in the sort of decade. Well, there was a period, wasn't there, between Lyon's dominance ending and PSG's dominance beginning.
Yeah, five teams, five different winners.
Exactly. Nobody could dominate the league. And of course, as you touch on, it becomes harder then for a team to really make a big impression in Europe when they're not dominating domestically. So there is a point to that, but I think it is interesting in France.
There's the DNCG as well.
The finances, of course, are very closely controlled, unlike maybe you would say in England, for example, and in Spain. But I think what you're saying is true, but at the same time, we probably agree. We say the three biggest clubs in France. I think the three biggest clubs in France in terms of support are Paris Saint-Germain, which is now is a combination of the fact that they're the only big team in the capital, and the success they've had in the last decade. Marseille, which of course they're the club from the second city, a passionate football city, but also because of the success they had in the early 90s. And the other team is Saint-Étienne, who still have a huge fan base exclusively because of what they did in the 70s and early 80s European Cup final, Michel Platini, all the rest of it. And they still have that massive support. And it's quite striking, really, because they're, if you want to be unkind, they're rubbish now and have been rubbish for a while, but they still have a huge support. So, history does count. It's not like there have not been any great French teams. There have been. And I think that's still borne out in terms of the support now. But you're right. I suppose the difference is that unlike Liverpool or Real Madrid or Bayern Munich or Ajax, none of those teams dominated European football. And that is something which has maybe played on the minds of French football in the years since. They've never been able. I mean, I say this periodically on the podcast, but I'm from Scotland. Scotland has won as many, if not more, European trophies than France. Scotland has a population that's like not even 10% that of France. So that is something that needs to change. And maybe PSG winning the Champions League, and imagine if Marseille won the Europa League as well. Can you imagine if that happened? Maybe that would change things forever. So let's just see.
Well, one thing I would like to add as well, because I think it's important to sort of bring the context in terms of what French football is going through at the moment. And that's that it's hugely important to factor in that now, like in terms of survival, it's in these clubs' interests to qualify for European competition, because the way that the league was saved by the CBC private equity deal, it's basically now designed to reward the clubs that regularly perform well and are continually qualifying for Europe. It's it's not like there's a different way of being able to see it. That's literally how the deal is structured. So in terms of saving French football, it's almost there's been a moment where the league has had to turn around to the clubs and say, right, if you want this money to survive, you now need to go and do the business on the continental stage, because otherwise French football, in Vincent Lebrun's words, will become sort of equivalent of the Slovenian league, I think it was what he said a couple of years ago.
But this comes back to what Andy and I were debating without debating it a few minutes ago, which is that the importance of European football is massive now. It is far more important than it ever has been. And that is a thing that is affecting not just the French league, but all the leagues in Europe and all the leagues around the world as well. So anyway, let's hope that Marseille win the Europa League and Paris Saint-Germain win the Champions League, and that French football and Ligue 1 can enjoy a bumper period riding on that wave. Don't forget to find out everything you need to know about all the top flight news in France, Ligue1.com. It's got match highlights, previews, stories, features, everything you need to know to stay right on top of Le Ballon Rond in France. All right, folks, so now it's time to start squinting and scratching your heads and pacing around, making sort of vaguely helpful gestures as you try and work out who I am talking about. That's right, it's time for Deja Who, the world's premier French football quiz in English. And we have, first of all, a winner to announce. April saw Deja Whoists competing for a signed Terramoffi jersey. The Nice forward The following two answers qualified you into the draw. David Ospina, who was signed by Nice to replace the outgoing club hero Hugo Lloris, or Lloris, when he signed for Lyon in 2008, was the first answer. The second one was Neil Mope, who holds the record for being the youngest to score in Liga Uber Eats in the 21st century. He was just 16 years old, 4 months and 1 day when he started firing the goals in for Nice. The youngest ever Ligue 1 scorer, however, remains Roger Bouquet, who scored for Sporting Club Fivoire in the 2-1 win over Racing Club of Paris. It was Sunday, February 10th, 1935, and Roger was 13 years old, 9 months and 22 days. Since then, France has brought in very strict labour laws, and kids aren't allowed to play in the French top flight, so there'll be no beating that record, not for the foreseeable future anyway. Well, it's time to announce the winner of that signed Terry Moffey jersey, and it is Henry Bethel, or perhaps that is Henri Bethel. He gave us two correct answers, got all the bonus trivia correct as well, so congratulations, Henri. Please get in touch. We'll make arrangements to get your prize sent out to you ASAP. And that brings us up to today's clue, up for grabs in May, a jersey from Monaco's US men's national team star striker Folarin Balogun. So here we go. Who am I? A three-time player of the year for my country. I came through the youth ranks in one of my hometown's most famous clubs, but was released after the supposed detection of a potential heart defect. I only played one top flight season in my homeland before escaping the war-torn country to play in the French Third Division, where I worked as a car mechanic to supplement my meagre salary. In my third year and second club in the semi-amateur Third Division, my potential was spotted by a Ligue 1 giant. I signed for them before heading straight back out on loan. I eventually returned and was part of an incredible generation that won the Ligue 1 title, a Coupe de la Ligue, and a Trophée des Champions. Off the back of a swashbuckling run in Europe, I moved across the channel for the final 3 years of my career, winning a league and cup double. Who am I, and what European record did I momentarily share during my time in France? So there you go. If you think you have the answers, send them in to via email, league1podcast@gmail.com, and you could go into the running for that splendid Folarin Balogun Monaco jersey. All right. Thank you for continuing to support this podcast. If you're enjoying it, we'd love it if you could leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. The best way to help us find other Anglophone French football fans around the world. That's the way to do it. Share the love, people, and keep us going. But it's time to wrap up. We'll look ahead to the final two rounds of the season. We have a couple of makeup games in midweek, or one coming up right now, Lille versus Olympique Lyonnais, and then OGC Nice versus Paris Saint-Germain and Reims versus Marseille in midweek. Those two matches pushed back because of the Champions League and Europa League semi-finals. They will certainly change a little bit. Lille versus Olympique Lyonnais for those European places. Reims, Marseille, perhaps less so. And Nice will be hoping to do the double over Paris Saint-Germain because they got that early win at the Parc this season where they scored 3 goals for a rare time. Mind you, they found a few goals in recent weeks, Nice. Andy, let's look ahead beyond that to round 33. Rennes versus Lens is a massive one for those Europa League, Conference League battles. Le Havre could secure safety if they get a win over Nice, but a slip-up would see them right back in the mix. Nantes take on Lille. Metz have to win against Strasbourg. Look, there are plenty of big games coming up. What there takes your fancy and why?
I think probably the most interesting thing now is the fight to decide who will secure automatic Champions League qualification. So maybe not against Lille this coming weekend, because regardless of what Lille do against Lyon, we're recording this before that game, they're going to need to get a result. You know, even if they're in the driving seat to finish in the top three, and they're playing a Nantes team who will be looking for a result to possibly secure their survival. So that's probably arguably the standout game. Although Rennes against Lens is an interesting one too, because obviously European qualification riding on that for Rennes in particular. Rennes have been in Europe about 5 years in a row, possibly 6 years in a row, and it would be a big disappointment for them to miss out. So they want to make sure that they get seventh place at the very least. Seventh might still be enough. So that is a big game too. And of course, always a great atmosphere at Roison Park. So that would be a good one to go to.
JJ, the final round of the season. There's still a whole lot that's going to be decided right down to round 34 of the season. Brest are away to Toulouse. That could be their last throw of the dice. I mean, it will certainly be their last throw of the dice. I don't think they can afford to slip up. Monaco are at home to Nantes. Nantes could still have plenty to be playing for as well. And there's Lille v Nice as well, which is probably one that will have the biggest impact on that. But at the other end of the table, it's probably just going to confirm Lorient v Clermont that it's all been too much for them this season. What takes your fancy in this final day of the season, JJ?
Well, I think depending on results, certainly that Lorient-Clermont game would be really interesting if one of them can potentially secure sort of the relegation playoff spot. It seems unlikely at the moment. So I think my choice would probably have to be Lille against Nice. I think given in terms of what could still be riding on it. I mean, again, some of the other games depend on sort of what's happening in terms of PSG and Marseille and their European involvement as well. But I do agree with Andy. I think if Rennes were able to beat Lens and potentially close the gap towards sixth position, that could set up a really interesting final day as well. So in the event that Lorient and Clermont are both confirmed relegated before the final round of games, I think I would still probably choose the Lille clash with Nice as the final game of the season.
Fantastic. JJ, thank you very much for joining us today. Enjoy the Parc des Princes tomorrow evening. It should be an absolute cracker.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Last time I was there, I had Andy Scott running up to excitedly tell me about the interview with Maxime Collin, which was one of the star turns of one of the recent episodes of the podcast.
Andy, do you have any more special interviews lined up for us in between running up and down stairs at the Parc des Princes? And will you be off to Marseille then for the... Oh, no, it's in Atalanta.
Yeah, it's in Bergamo, no interviews before tomorrow night's game, which I'll be at as well. But I believe there is something else lined up for the podcast in the coming days, but I won't give anything more away just now, just to say it would be a very exciting one indeed.
Fantastic. And then you'll also have a Coupe de France final where I assume you'll both be as well. Thank you for joining us, gentlemen. Le Beaujeu. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with a cracker of a final show of the season. The dust will just be starting to settle on the 2023-24 campaign. Our full house of panelists will break down the final two rounds of the season. We'll look back and revisit the bold predictions to see who was right and who was wrong, and who's got the most egg on their faces. There'll be a Le Beaujeu All-Star 11. We'll be looking ahead to that Coupe de France final between Lyon and Paris Saint-Germain as well, and hopefully some European finals as well in the Champions League for PSG and the Europa League for OM. Meantime, Professor Andreas Evagora will also be back with his final look back at the Ligue 1 legends for the season. He'll be looking at a certain Kylian Mbappe and how he became the world's best player. We'll have that last chance to win the Follerin Balogun jersey. And so until then, on behalf of the entire Le Beaujeu team, it's au revoir, bon match, et à bientôt.
Bye-bye.